Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and this is episode 7 of the podcast Revolution Z. First, however, a brief appeal. If you like the podcast, if you'd like to support the podcast, if you'd like Revolution Z to grow and to diversify, you can help us at our Patreon page, which is at www.patreon.com/revolutionz. And now, on to the episode, which is titled, Who Decides What? In prior episodes, Revolution Z has addressed the need for vision. We laid an ethical foundation for assessing vision. We discussed what should determine people's income in a worthy economy. We decided on, or we proposed, duration, intensity, and onerousness of socially valued work. And we discussed issues of property as well. Who should own what? Whether ownership should even exist of productive assets, workplaces, and resources, and the like. I hope that content has been helpful. At the outset, to help orient our task, I ethically advocated, among other values, the idea that everyone should have a say in decisions in proportion as they are affected by the decisions. If you're affected more, you have more say. If you're affected less, you have less say. And elaborating on that desire will be our focus for this time. The claim is that in a worthy economy, a worthy society, decisions affecting only me, I should make unilaterally. What color socks I wear in the morning, I should decide alone. Whether I should have a picture of a spouse on my desk at work or in the wall at work, that again, I should decide. Decisions equally affecting all members of a group, and not others outside the group should make unilaterally, each member having an equal say. Perhaps a work team's daily schedule, for example. But complicating matters in a group that's making decisions, if I am more affected, I should have more say. Imagine a group of people deciding whether or not to go to a movie. One person proposes a movie. Three really like it, but the fourth says, I saw that. That would be horrible for me. Okay, that person has more say because it affects them so much. That's typical behavior. They move on for another movie and they get an agreement. Imagine a workplace and it's hiring people. It might be that the work team handles this by one person, one vote, except for one thing. If somebody is hired who somebody in the work team can't get along with, it would really adversely affect that person. So in that case, that person would have more say. That's the broad idea. People should be able to express their desires and their preferences, but more, when somebody is seriously affected by a decision, they should have more say in that decision than people who are less affected. I called the approach to decision-making self-management, and I proposed it as a value to guide our efforts at conceiving social vision for a better society. I claimed that a society that attains self-management is better for that fact. I claim that a society that deviates from self-management is worse for that fact, and the more it deviates, the worse it is. If you consider our current society, it's obviously less worse than, say, a brutal dictatorship, but it is still quite horrible. In our society, in workplaces, most people have no say at all in what is going on. The decisions are made entirely by management and by owners and by pressures from the broader society. But the actual worker who's doing the work basically follows orders. Regarding political decisions, it's really not much different. Who runs is largely determined by vast political parties and their donors, their investors, the people who buy the outcome. The average person has very little say in that. Even in primaries, the will of the populace can be overthrown by various means, as we've seen in recent elections. But more important even than elections, once people are in office, they operate virtually insulated from the public. The public is not in a position to manifest its preferences and to influence the outcomes in proportion as they're affected. This is obvious in the United States, for example, where the public wants lots of things that the government never delivers, never even thinks about delivering, such as healthcare for all, public education for all, better housing, better infrastructure, and on and on. These things aren't delivered. They aren't even discussed, and that's because decisions in the political sphere are left almost exclusively not only to elected officials, but to their aides and to their backers, their donors, the people who buy the outcomes. Okay. We can easily see that to fulfill the aim of achieving self-management, whether in the economy or in any other realm of life, even if we're not talking about achieving it to, you know, the third decimal place of precise accuracy, but at least to everyone's broad satisfaction and in an efficient manner, is quite a demanding standard. I suspect we can also agree that to do so would certainly be ethically impressive, as it would treat everyone fairly and also consistently with broader values like equity and solidarity and diversity. The issue is, can we actually do it? And if we do it, will there be any severe debits? To see the complexity of the situation, that is, that it is hard to do this, consider that when I decide to consume some item from the overall social product, something goes to me that could have gone elsewhere. If I consume a car, it has lots of steel in it, it has lots of rubber in the tires, and it has various other things in it. And if I wasn't getting that, it could go someplace else. Therefore, it affects other people. If you think about the total of cars going to people, if that total wasn't going to people, then all that material and all those resources and all the labor that went into it could go to something else, like really good public transportation or better housing and so on and so forth. The archetype example is the military. If instead of huge resources, actually incredibly vast resources, going into military equipment and maintenance, missiles and tanks and weaponry and all the rest, which does nothing good for anybody, if instead of that, all that material and all that labor went into a different direction, it went into public education and health care and housing and entertaining venues and city centers and on, then society would be much better off. Regardless of whether you think it would be better off, it's clear that there's a decision being made and that isn't being made by the public. So that means we don't have self-management. The idea is that those elsewhere are affected when a decision has broader implications. And those elsewhere who are affected, if we are to have self-management, need to have some say. And altogether, they need to have quite a lot of say. Consider a decision to consume some particular item. For example, an item's production or its disposal might entail pollution. The pollution might affect people elsewhere, perhaps slightly for each, but a lot in total. Again, to have self-management in the workplace that's producing that polluting material has to have some say in the decision to do so, and altogether a whole lot of say. Is the benefit of doing that production worth the cost in terms of the pollution effects upon people? Well, you can only tell that if people are able to manifest their preferences, if people are able to express themselves and have an influence. Self-management. Another example, if I decide to wear my black socks tomorrow and not my blue ones, for all intents, that choice just affects me, so I should decide dictatorially. No one else should get much or even any say in that decision. When a decision is implications are narrowed to one or two or three people, then they should be the ones deciding and that's it. But if I decide to buy a whole lot of socks, that does have tiny outward effects. So others should impact that decision, however minimally, not just me. If the whole society decides all of a sudden to buy tons of socks, well, that affects everyone significantly because it would affect the availability of other clothing because of all the resources and labor it would use. Suppose I decide to consume some of my auto equipment ferociously loudly. That, too, might affect others who should have some say, and perhaps a lot of say, and maybe even veto power, depending upon how loud we're talking about. If a workplace is spewing fumes that contribute to global warming, and that threatens extinction, somehow all those who will suffer, which is virtually everybody, needs to have their preferences count. These are all manageable complexities, I will in time argue, So far, there's no reason to believe that. But for now, let's start a bit simpler. Consider a workplace. Within a workplace, we can see that how a work team allocates its time and arranges and conducts its activities, assuming the team operates in accord with broader agreed decisions taken by the whole workplace or by the whole society. For example, prior decisions about the timing of holidays, the length of the workday, and the level and character of workplace product and output is largely or even completely the team's choice. In other words, if in a workplace it's decided in concert with consumers how much is going to be produced and various things concerning those outside the workplace, and then the workers have to decide, okay, what schedule are we going to work on to produce that much? How are we going to organize ourselves to produce that much? How are we going to interact together? What are we going to do each day to produce that much? Well, those decisions are up to them. Within a team, what affects only them is theirs to decide. Within a team, however, if someone is dramatically affected by some aspect, according to our self-management ethic, she should get more say about that. To achieve that, to achieve self-management, where different levels of impact are accorded in the decisions, some decisions may best be taken by one person, one vote, majority rules, because everyone is comparably affected. But other decisions may best require two-thirds to pass, or even a variant of consensus in cases where anyone might be horrendously adversely affected, so everyone should have a veto. Some decisions will have more time set aside for deliberation, because that seems more suitable, especially deliberation about dissenting views. Maybe hiring a new member requires, which means the team has agreed that it requires, two-thirds to pass, but also that anyone can veto. I was once in an organization called South End Press where that's basically the way we operated regarding hirings. It turns out that with a self-management view, diverse ways of tallying preferences are just methods that we judiciously choose to best approach self-management. In other words, self-management is the principle. Not one person, one vote, majority rules, not consensus, and not any other method serving self-management. We choose among deliberation and voting procedures so as to best attain self-management, at least as best we can, not because one or another option is always superior. In other words, we don't always have one person, one vote, majority rules, because one person, one vote, majority rules is an absolute that we must always respect. We have it only if it is the best way to attain, or at least to best approximate, self-management for all who are affected by the decision. One person, one vote, majority rules of everyone on my work team about my choice of socks would be idiotic. One person, one vote, three-quarters support required for a new hire, but anyone who feels that the proposed hire would make his or her life miserable can veto, might make excellent sense. Having different methods for different situations may seem strange, but it turns out that it is actually how caring friends or workmates most often relate to one another when we are free to do so. So it is not really as unfamiliar as an abstract description might make it seem. Again, consider the case of a group about to go to the movie. There's no group of friends who care about each other who would vote 4-1 for a particular movie and then enforce that decision if the person who voted against had already seen it. People do, in fact, understand what it means to take into account the degree to which a decision affects other people. Similarly, some workmates are arranging their schedule, and suppose that one of them has a difficult situation with family or with health or whatever, and that the schedule that everybody wants would put that person in a very difficult situation. What happens? Well, it may well be that that becomes the schedule for all except one person, rather than that not being the schedule. But in any event, that one person's needs would be taken into account. There is no denying that many workplace decisions reverberate outward. What technology we employ affects how what we produce and therefore what others get to consume. This affects those other people. It isn't just a matter of the effect of the technology inside the workplace. What forms of energy we use and what we do with our waste, affects our neighbors, and perhaps far more widely. It isn't just a question of whether and how it affects us inside of our workplace. It affects others. If we choose to honor self-management, then workplace decisions have to be made in ways that give appropriate influence to affected workers in the specific workplace, but that also give appropriate influence to affected folks outside the workplace. For now, pending our discussion of what economists call allocation, the means by which people regulate what is produced and what is consumed and where it goes, the interactions among firms, pending our discussion of that, where we will see how broader constituencies exert a say on both the consumption and production side of issues, let's just consider folks inside a workplace. What is the implication of advocating self-management for decisions inside workplaces, assuming, for the moment, that influence from outside is well addressed by structures that we still haven't discussed? First, of course, all the workers are going to be affected by many workplace decisions, so they altogether need a venue and methods by which to have their share of say. Call this venue the Workers' Council. Basically, it is the whole workforce able to meet, deliberate, and take votes when need be. Many decisions affect all workers essentially equally. For example, the length and timing of the workday. When do we have the lights on or off? What's the duration and time of breaks? How do we use air conditioning? What's the total output and therefore the total work level? And what are our norms about clothing, noise levels, or what holidays to observe? But wait just a second. Is it so obvious that all those affect everyone the same? What if those with families and those without have markedly different dependency depending on the timing of arrival and departure from work? What if some people have conditions that make air conditioning far more important for them? What if different workers of different nationalities or religions are differently impacted by holiday choices? We could go on. The answer for how to address all such variations among workforces is up to each workplace to determine. After all, they collectively self-manage themselves. Sessions of workers' councils in each workplace first arrive at various procedures that are deemed sufficient, or when possible, even ideal, for giving affected parties appropriate say in decisions. Perhaps this list of options is revisited yearly or bi-yearly, and it certainly may be different in different workplaces due to their different features and the different preferences of their workers. Some workplaces may want to emphasize one person, one vote majority rules in many more cases than another workplace, which tends to prefer options that involve differential requirements, like one person, one vote, but three quarters required, or veto allowed, and so on. But once such agreed procedures exist inside a workplace, one or more is chosen as appropriate for each new case, and deliberations proceed, as do decisions. It is in everyone's interest that matters are handled sensibly, without undue time wasting, and attending to the needs of all involved. We can imagine workers' councils deciding the pace of work, but also whether there is daycare at work, deciding job definitions, but also holiday schedules. But the workers' council can't just do any old thing they may think up. Consumers and workers elsewhere provide an overarching context we'll discuss in due time. But the point is, each by themselves, together in their work teams, and all together in their whole workers' council, workers have a say in what affects them. Some would say phooey on all this. Let's let one person just decide. It's much less messy. Well, the logic of democracy, and beyond democracy of self-management, is that imposed order is not, in fact, less messy. It just buries the mess, hiding the fact of people being alienated and of people getting inferior outcomes given their needs beneath an imposed order. One workplace may lean toward more streamlining, though, and more often adopt more cut-and-dried procedures. Another workplace may lean differently, incorporating more time for deliberation, for hearing minority views, and for exploring them. Indeed, I might very sensibly choose where I want to work, and you might choose where you want to work, in part in accord with our taste for workplace methods. In any case, we can reasonably predict that over time, with experience, Various approaches will prove to be better at arriving smoothly and rapidly at desirable and collectively respected outcomes. And so those approaches will come to be used more often. It's all a matter within a firm for the firm's workers' council. That is the repository of decision-making power. Not an owner, not a boss, the workers' council. It sounds good, but here are two broad issues to address if we want to vigorously advocate self-management. The first is a complaint that turns out to be pretty simple to resolve. The second is a derivative need that is more complex and consequential for a new economy and society, but also has to be solved if self-management is to be workable. First, some would complain that if we require such extensive decision-making participation, we will diminish the quality of decisions that are made. We will have self-management, but we will have crappy decisions whose fallout will hurt and even devastate us. In other words, this complaint says, why shouldn't Joe get more or less say, depending on how good a decision-maker Joe is? And more generally, doesn't the self-management approach undercut the benefits of expertise? The answer to this complaint is that the opinions of experts and expertise more generally are, of course, incredibly important. But the fact that Joe is an expert in, let's say, engineering or chemistry or whatever else is consequential to some decision should not convey to Joe more influence, more votes, even in a decision that quite strongly involves engineering or chemistry. Joe's expertise should certainly be consulted. We ask Joe what he thinks. We listen to his reply. But once that occurs, then Joe has a say like others, not elevated. Now imagine we're in a workplace and we're deciding to paint the walls. We're choosing between a bunch of different colored paints. Most of us prefer the yellow one. It turns out the yellow one has lead in it. Joe explains to us why this is a terrible choice. Joe doesn't get to veto it. Joe doesn't get more votes than the rest of us. But he does get time to explain to us. His expertise plays a role. And then, of course, we don't choose the yellow lead paint. We do something far more sensible. The point is, Joe is not an expert in how much a decision affects me or you, much less in how you or I feel about it. And so we have a say in the decision due to our expertise in its effect on us. Nonetheless, we should certainly pay close attention to Joe's insights, to his expertise. It turns out, if you think about it, that each of us is the world's foremost expert in our own preferences. You know yours, I know mine. Self-management, therefore, looks to us, the experts, when tallying preferences. But when deliberating self-management wants inputs about the effects so that we can judge those before we arrive at our preferences, well, when possible, we get that from experts. But now let's consider a related dimension of the worry over the quality of decisions issue. Suppose that Susan has proved over time to have an incredible facility for always advocating decisions that experience shows to be wisest. Susan is a very good decision maker. Make it, Susan is simply the best in the workplace. Make it even, she is best by a large margin. Okay, in that case, why not simplify work life by having Susan make all decisions? Ignoring that the assumptions are highly unreal once we have participating prepared workers, once each is potentially bringing to deliberations and votes different experiences, this imagine Susan is best scenario also ignores the value of each person feeling a decision was reached respecting his or her input and say. If experts not just offering their wisdom for others to evaluate and even learn from, but instead deciding outcomes is better, then that rules out not only self-management, but also even more limited democracy. The reason this argument fails is first because there is no such general and universal expertise. And second, and even more important, it is because people's exclusion from decisions creates problems far worse than a somewhat worse choice being made, even if that did happen now and then. Participation matters. The more complex issue that worries about the quality of self-management is how to ensure that all workers are prepared and able to contribute positively to decision-making. That's a real issue. For we know that if we have lots of workers who have neither the confidence, the skills, the knowledge to have sufficiently informed views to make good decisions, then their involvement will give us seriously flawed results. In a good economy, a good society, what can prevent that? That is, in most workplaces now, the number of people in the whole workforce in position to have informed opinions and to have the confidence to make good choices is maybe 1 out of every 5. Why is that? How do we raise it to 5 out of 5? That is a precondition of effective, optimal, self-managed decision-making, and therefore something we must accomplish. We take up precisely that issue of universal preparedness for decision-making in the next episode in our vision exploration, and the issue of class relations and class rule as well. But for now, this is Michael Albert, signing off for Revolution Z. Until next time.